Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment. This is your navigator once again, John Lash, recording on the 31st of October. And this nav briefing, number 34, is a follow-up to the previous one called Focusing the GNE. The main topic of this briefing is, of course, the upcoming occultation of Jupiter by the Moon. The date of this occultation is Friday, November 2nd at 1 hour Universal Time. And this would be our second test of Channel 16. So I'd like to brief you on this upcoming moment and to add a little more to the specifications for our telepathic experiment, and possibly also clarify and focus some of the aspects of this experiment. Before I go to that topic, however, I'd like to make a couple of important corrections relative to my last briefing. There were two errors in that briefing, one an error of misstatement, and another an error concerning the narrative of the Aeon Sophia. So in the first case, toward the end of that briefing, I was talking about confronting evil. And I mentioned the saying that all it takes for evil to succeed is that good people stand by and do nothing. And I also cited the conversation between Faust and Mephistopheles in Goethe's Faust, wherein Mephistopheles identifies himself by saying that he is a power that would alone work evil but engenders good. And at one point, I was talking about what is required for that power to work alone and to work on its own. And what I meant to say was that it works on its own and thereby achieves an inordinate degree of influence and pervasion in human affairs as long as so-called good people do not confront it. Do not confront it. So it works on its own as long as it is not exposed and confronted. But the statement of Mephistopheles coming from the imagination of Goethe implies that were it to be otherwise, that is to say, if evil did not work on its own, undetected and unimpeded, then it would somehow contribute to the good in the world. Let me repeat that line exactly. When Faust asks him, "Who then are you?" Mephistopheles replies, "Part of a power that would alone work evil, but engenders good." So we must ask then, well, how could it be that the power that works evil in the world could somehow engender good? This is a question, a very big question to live with in the coming months, and especially in the next 2.5 months as we move into the stall of the lunar apogee. So I just want to reiterate what I said in the previous briefing and clarify that point about the power that, left to its own, works evil. So the key syntax is, don't leave it to its own devices. And it therefore falls upon the responsibility of good people, or that is, people who consider themselves to be good and who do not practice evil, it falls upon them to see that the powers of evil do not operate on their own, undetected and unimpeded. So I have a lot more to say about this in the near future. Second point I want to make is that I made an error regarding the statement of Sophia observing the previous experiments with the Anthropos, 9 previous experiments with the Anthropos. And I said that she observed them before the Anthropos was seated in the galactic limbs. Of course, that's impossible. What actually happened, and this belongs to episode 4 of the 9-part narrative, is that after she and Thelete designed the Anthropos, the master template, as it were, the entire Pleromic company of Aeons assisted them in planting it in the galactic arms. And then they all observed from the observation booth at the center of the galaxy how the Anthropos plasm, which consists of a base of nucleic acid or nous and a 7-fold compound of capacities, propagated itself in various world systems. And they observed 9 instances in which our current form of humanity and the current form of the human animal species or anthropine species actually emerged in 9 different worlds and 9 different planetary systems. So obviously, Sophia could not have observed those experiments unfolding if the Anthropos plasm had not already been seeded somewhere out there in the galactic arms. So with those 2 points corrected, I'd like to move into the topic of this briefing, but also just want to say, in reference to what's happening right now with the Gaia navigation experiment, that there are a few points of activity that are worth mentioning. First of all, I want to thank Simon for his unfaltering and usually rapid help in getting these nav briefings uploaded. Also, you will notice that if you go to Gaiaspora and you go to crewnotes/channel16, he has posted a universal time clock right there on the page where we are observing the occultations. So you can always know what is universal time on the planet by simply going to that page. And then you can see and compare the time indicated against your own local time. In my case, for instance, it now says 11:47 universal time. And the clock time here in Spain is 12:47, 1 hour later. So I'm going to watch the clock until it comes around to 1 hour universal time on Friday morning, and that will be 2 a.m. here in Spain. So this is how we observe the exact moment of these occultations. So thanks very much, Simon, for that tool. And I also want to point out that a couple of days ago, as I was stumbling around the internet, I came across a Facebook page called Sophia's Correction. Now, I don't know who set this up. It could be somebody on the crew. It looks pretty good to me. I didn't know there was such a page. And I don't really know that much about it because I just skimmed over it. But it appears to be more or less rigorously observing the parameters of this experiment and staying within the boundaries. So I'm grateful for this additional platform on the internet. And I send out my nod of appreciation to whoever set that up. Also, I want to point out that I've been looking into the Channel 16 forum which I will be contributing to in a minor way from time to time. And very happy to see the comments that are in there. I'm happy to observe that people are polite and respectful and that they're staying on topic. And there are some really, really remarkable observations and comments in there regarding the meaning of the graphic image for our Channel 16 experiment. That is to say, the dance with Banderillas from the line drawing of Picasso. It so happens that right now, as I'm making this briefing, I'm also in the process of writing some crew notes, and that would be crew notes number 22. And I mention in those notes the following. Channel 16 test image. First of all, thanks to all of you for your participation in the Channel 16 test run on October 5th and your ongoing contributions on the Channel 16 forum. I can see that the Picasso image is working as our provisional visual reference for testing Channel 16. About that image, by the way, I received my library and archives at Ambergain House on Friday, October 12th, and among the boxes I initially opened, I found the source of the lithograph. Picasso Dance with Banderillas was done on February 14th, so it's Valentine's Day, 1954. It is a lithograph 9 inches by 25 inches, and it is plate 164 in the book Picasso, 55 Years of His Graphic Work, published by Harry N. Abrams Publishers in New York and Amsterdam in 1965. So with that magnificent image, at least I consider it to be so, floating like a sugar plum in our minds, we can return to the main topic of this briefing, which is the next lunar occultation of Jupiter. That would be, formally speaking, test 2, or test run 2, of our experiment with Channel 16. Now, I don't propose any changes, if you'll bear with me. I don't propose any changes right now in the method or in the message for this telepathic test event. So I'm going to ask you if you'll proceed as before. Take some time, a half an hour leading into the exact moment, a half an hour leading away. Take some time to quiet your mind. And when you feel a little bit of inner silence, or when the mental radio that is always running in your head clicks off for a moment, then send out the call signal, which is GNE 516. And this is an important thing, this call signal. It may seem trivial, it may seem even a little silly, but believe me, it isn't. We really need a call signal to establish that we are all on this channel at the same time. We're all checking in at the same moment. And then proceed with contemplating the test image, which is the nonverbal content of the transmission, and occasionally repeating subvocally the message. The message being that we intend to realize what are the male and female polarities of divine imagination. You can rephrase it as you like, but stay on message, if you will, and keep close to the essential significance of that trigger phrase. So we'll proceed in this way as we did before, was I would guess that it would take 3 times doing this before the exercise could be modified. So we would have the advantage of 3 occasions to compare our results, observations, and so forth, before we in any way change or alter the basic elements of the experiment. We already did the first test run on October 5th. Upcoming is the second on November 2nd, the third on November 29th. And then we come to the fourth, which is on December 26th, just a few days after the winter solstice, 2012. So I propose that that test run, number four, in December, could be extremely significant. And by then we would have some, let's say we'd have gained some competence and confidence in this experiment. And who knows what message we might be able to broadcast to the world at large through Channel 16 at that moment, which is filled with such great expectation. Certainly that is a moment when, and it'll be a little bit after that moment, which is good, because I have a feeling that the 21st of December 2012 may very well be like so many of those highly hyped and anticipated moments, somewhat of a letdown in certain respects, and it may be that in the silence of the anticlimax of that moment, there is an extraordinary opportunity to transmit through Channel 16. So we'll stick to the current image and the current message for the next two occasions, and then we'll see what comes up for the late December test. Now, what I'd like to do in the remainder of this briefing is to sharpen, if I can, to sharpen the focus of this test. I keep using this word focus. It's interesting how it's coming up. Remember that one of the five meanings of resolution is focus. Something that is in perfect focus is in very, very high resolution, isn't it? Now, it's really interesting to consider that the eye of the bull could be like a lens of a camera. And that what we are doing in this experiment, the telepathy experiment, which is a special event within the Gaia navigation experiment, what we are doing is focusing on the instrument of focus, okay? So imagine that someone is standing among us who has a camera, like a beautiful Sony camera, like an EOS, which I happen to have, strangely enough. And imagine that it has a zoom lens attached to it. You all know what that looks like. And so at a certain point, we all turn and we focus on the instrument of focus. This is what we're doing with the exercise, with the constellation of the bull centered on Aldebaran, which is the eye of the bull. Focusing on the cosmic instrument of focus. And one of the intentions of this exercise with Channel 16, and the larger intention of this experiment as a whole, is to achieve a high resolution of perception, a high resolution of Gnostic and intuitive insight regarding certain particular issues of the divine experiment. Each of the constellations of the sky and the 13 constellations of the zodiac are multivalent and multi-thematic. And so you master the celestial code, which I call Starbase. You master it, you learn to read it by understanding what are the themes comprised in each of these constellations. If you go back to the book, Hamlet's Mill, by Santayana and von Dekkant, you'll find that they use in that book a peculiar word, implex. They don't use the word complex, they use the word implex. As you may or may not know, the book Hamlet's Mill, which was first published in 1969, is a classic of stellar mythology. And the topic of this book, which is expressed in one metaphoric image as Hamlet's Mill, is the precession of the equinoxes. So the motion of the earth by which the north pole of the earth, the spindle formed by the north pole going through the material sphere of the earth, the mechanism by which that spindle makes a revolution in the heavens every 26,000 years has been compared to a mill turning. That is the cosmic mill, as referenced in the old folk saying, the mills of the gods grind slow, but they grind exceeding fine. Well, there you go. There's another example of language that alludes to resolution. That is to say, a mill that grinds exceeding fine grinds in granular detail. It grinds at very, very high resolution. And I can guarantee you, from my study of the 26,000 year of the Kalpa, 26,000 year cycle of the Kalpa, which is one day of aeonic time, that the events that unfold in that Kalpa in such a time period conform to certain patterns reflected by the array of constellations, and the events comprised in those patterns, the human events, the historical and psychological and spiritual events that transpire in that cycle, can be investigated in granular detail. So there is a high resolution of this cycle through an understanding of the constellations that lie on the path of the vernal point during those 26,000 years. And these are called the world ages or the zodiacal ages. So a Harvard professor or a professor of science at MIT, Santayana, and his associate, Erta von Dechen, wrote this book, which is practically unreadable. And yet it is nevertheless a classic and a foundational book of archaeoastronomy and sidereal studies of history. Well, when I read Hamlet's Mill, I was struck by their use of this word implex, because I'd never seen it used anywhere else, and I haven't since. But I'm going to use it right now. But before I do so, allow me to define it for you, if I may. It's defined in this manner on an internet site. Implex, from Latin implexus, which is the past perfect, past participle, I guess, of the word implectere, which means to enfold. To infold, and it's related to the Latin plectere, meaning to plait. So implex means intricate, entangled, complicated, or complex. But actually, Santayana and von Dechen used it as a noun, and they talked about an implex. And what is an implex? Well, an implex is what you see when you look at the constellation of the bull. The constellation of the bull, first of all, consists of a composite of stars in the sky. When you look at that composite, you do not see the head of a bull. You just see the grouping of the stars. And generally speaking, you can see all of the stars in the bull composite without moving your eyes. So the constellation is small enough so that you don't have to scan to take in all its constituent stars. To that act of observation, you add an act of visualization. You picture the head of a bull, the long horns of the bull, the eye of the bull, and the cluster of the Pleiades on the neck or hump of the bull. That's a visualization, an act of imagination that you add to the observation of the composite stars. Now, there's a further act involved in this method of sidereal mythology, and that is the act of associating or correlating certain concepts with that mythical image. And the totality of those concepts make up the implex of the bull. So there is the implex of the bull, the implex of the fishes, the implex of the ram. All of the constellations have their own implex. And the implex is, as the word suggests, an intricate entanglement of themes. So there is no single and simple theme for any constellation, unfortunately. I mean, I've probably, as far as I know, I have labored like Hercules. And interestingly, the 12 labors of Hercules are often compared to the 12 constellations, excluding the snake tamer. I have labored and struggled for a good many years to try to boil down the themes correlated to these massive mythic images. And it's really, really impossible to do so. You can do it, but it's an act of reductionism that at the end of the day doesn't really hang together too well. So, for instance, I can say that the constellation of the fishes concerns the theme of guidance, and that's absolutely correct. And that can be verified, and it can be shown by looking at historical events that are connected with the timing of planetary movements in the constellation of the fishes, or looking at historical events marked by the star clock, the movement of the vernal point. So when I say that guidance is a main theme of the constellation of the fishes, I can verify that, I can back up that statement, and I can do so with other statements as well. But at the end of the day, the constellation of the fishes, just like the ram, the bull, and the twins, and all the others, involves an implex. It involves the constellation that you visualize in the sky involves a constellation of psychic and thematic counterparts, and there's no way you can get around it. So we're looking here at a vast, vast repository of phylogenetic memories of our species, and also a vast reservoir of the dreamings of the aeons themselves. So no wonder that the mysteries of the sky are immense and ultimately unfathomable, and you can spend lifetimes upon lifetimes exploring them. But to bring it down to the here and now, and to bring it down to the practical purposes of our experiment, the crucial thing to do is to be able to decode each of these constellational images into the component themes that make up the implex of that image. So what component themes form the implex of the bull? Well, one of them is the directive power of divine imagination. Another one is the aesthetic and erotic power of the feminine and of the goddess, the mother power of the goddess. Another one would be the integrity of the sexes as a dynamic unity or a dyad. And that theme of the several themes we can attach to the bull, that particular theme brings to mind very vividly the Picasso image. Depicted in that image as a naked man, a naked woman, in the gestures that you are now familiar with. The man kneeling in a devotional gesture of service and of reverence before the woman. The woman taking an action upon the head of the bull, which may be considered as a purely symbolic action in a way. She is the one who plants the banderillas in the forehead of the bull. But the bull has been severed from its head, so she plants them into the head of the bull. Normally, and Picasso knew this very well, because he was, after all, a Spaniard born in Malaga, about 40 miles from here. And he knew very well that the purpose of the banderillas was to sever the neck muscles of the bull so that its head would droop. And then the final coup de grace could be delivered to the bull by a sword stroke that reached a certain artery in the bull's neck, which is actually an act of mercy because it allows the bull to die and to bleed to death very rapidly. And so Picasso certainly knew all that, but in his artistic imagination, he decided to show only the bull's head. So if the bull's head is severed from the body, the bull is obviously no longer a threat. So the man is presenting something to the woman that is no longer a threat. But then the woman is applying the banderillas as a symbolic act of her participation in mastering that which was a threat and that which is a threat. So this raises a question, or what is the threat? I mean, now we're looking at the constellation of the bull, which includes, by the way, part of the body of the bull. I should include a number of sketches, or just go look on image search on the internet, and you'll see that the front part of the bull, its four legs, and the upper part of its body, the massive shoulders and the neck, are often depicted in drawings of that constellation. Okay, so the brute force of the bull is represented here. What is this brute force? Put a name to that, and we have yet another component in the implex of the bull constellation. Now, as we proceed with this Channel 16 telepathy experiment, I urge you to contemplate from time to time the different aspects or components of the implex here. Primarily, we're focusing on one factor of the implex in the language that I've proposed. That is, we are seeking to understand, and it would be absolutely magnificent if we could understand this and bring this into language. Now, I'm sure that we will be able to do so, seeking to understand and define what are the masculine and feminine polarities of divine imagination. Now, I haven't said what they are yet, and I really don't know what to say yet. I'm with you in this experiment, proceeding toward that realization. Some of you are writing about it on the Channel 16 forum, and I must say, you're saying some brilliant things about man, woman, and the bull power. So let's just take a moment here to consider what the bull power is as far as the brute force is concerned. Well, I think that is more or less obvious, isn't it? When we speak about brute force applied by human beings, what do we call it? We use a word that begins with V. violence. So, in some respect, among the other multivalent and multi-thematic aspects of the bull, it represents the force of violence. Now, I'd like to point out something which I have written about, am in the process of writing about, in Crew Notes number 22. So this will give you a little preview of what is coming up in those Crew Notes. I know that the astronomical aspects of the GNE are a challenge to some of you. I'm still going to do my Astronomy 101 talk very soon with the intention of making that a little easier for you. But I will say that no matter what you learn from participation in the GNE about sky watching, there is, above and beyond all else, one factor that is most important. And this is also, in a way, the easiest factor, and that is the observation of the planet Jupiter. So what you're learning in the course of this three-year period is how to observe the planet Jupiter, that you'll be able to recognize it in the night sky, and with a little work, you'll be able to know where to look for it, when it appears in the morning sky, when it appears in the evening sky, and so forth. I certainly like to think that I've impressed on you by now, I've impressed on your minds the importance of Jupiter in the correction of the Aeon Sophia. I've stated on many occasions that the Aeon Sophia is the indwelling force of this planet Earth, has the capacity to use the powers of the archontic planetary system in any way she likes. She conferred upon the archons the power to construct the planetary system, exclusive of the sun, moon, and earth itself. I can't repeat too often that fact, which is not my construction, but is a statement found in the cosmological treatises of Nag Hammadi. So, it's very clear that the divine Sophia as an aeon lent her powers to the archons to construct the planetary system. And any time that she wants to draw upon the inertial power of the archonic celestial mechanics, she can do so. And this is real physics I'm talking here, although I'm putting it out in a mythological medium, in a mythological jargon. This is real physics I'm talking about. And so at the beginning of this experiment, I made the declaration, the correction of the Aeon Sophia takes place in the apsides of Jupiter. And the apsides of the planet Jupiter lie approximately in 16 degrees of Aries, that's its closest point to the sun, and 16 degrees of Libra, its point most distant from the sun. And as I pointed out, that's exactly where Jupiter itself stood on March 19th when the initial conditions of correction were initiated. Okay. Now, I'd like to point out something else to you. Throughout this three-year period of the GNE, you are being advised to observe Jupiter. Currently, Jupiter stands, as we know, between the eye of the bull, Aldebaran, and the star Elnat, marking the tip of the northern horn. And we have watched Jupiter reach that point over the last 14 months, coming out of the constellation of the fishes, passing through the ram, actually below the ram, because the ram is a small constellation located rather displaced, rather above the planetary orbital path, and then moving into the constellation of the bull. So we've observed these motions of Jupiter very closely. This fall of this spring of March 2012, we also observed a magnificent sight of Jupiter and Venus meeting together in the evening sky. So the observation of Jupiter is the single most important factor of sky watching for all of you to learn in the course of this experiment. And I'd just like to point out to you something that I have written about or am currently writing about on Crew Notes 22. During the 3 years when Sophia achieves the initial conditions of her correction, her human accomplices have the opportunity to learn three great lessons. These lessons are shown by the movement of Jupiter, or to be more precise, these lessons are focalized and located in time in a very specific way. These lessons are defined by three moments: 29th of October, 2011, the 3rd of December, 2012, this is coming up, happens to be my birthday, and the 6th of January, 2014. These three moments are three moments when the Earth is neck and neck with Jupiter. Bear in mind that the orbit of the Earth is within the orbit of Jupiter. They're like two circular racetracks. The Earth is on the smaller interior racetrack. Jupiter is on an outer, larger racetrack. And consequently, the Earth overtakes Jupiter at a certain point in their mutual movement, circular movement around the racetracks. These are the exact moments when that happens. These are the midpoints of the three Jupiter retrograde cycles in this three-year period. And each one of them focuses this experiment on a lesson. The lesson that we learned by the conjunction of the Earth and Jupiter before the satanic head of Cetus was a lesson about the various masks of evil, and we actually learned how to demask evil. During our long exercising contemplation of the satanic head of Cetus, we came to understand that evil wears many masks, because the evil behavior of human beings can only persist by concealing itself and disguising itself. When it's out in the open, it is easily defeated. It is very difficult to defeat when it hides and uses deceit, disguise, and secrecy, as of course it does. So there are many masks of evil behavior, and the labels we put on them are Zionism, the Jesuits, the Freemasons, international Jewish banking cabal, the feds, and so forth and so on. Now, you may recall the result of that exercise in contemplating the satanic head of Cetus, which would have culminated in, at that moment, in October last year. The result is that when all these masks are stripped away, what is there looking at us, staring at us behind all these masks? Well, given that the evil we're trying to understand is of human origin, that's a very, very important point, my friends. Evil is of human origin. Evil is that is what human beings do against the cause of life and against the divine experiment. It is human behavior. The orchestrations of social evil, such as communism, are phenomena of human behavior, pure and simple. And when we strip all the masks away, we find that that behavior is performed by human animals who are in a state of paranoid insanity. And I advise that their insanity, which has numerous aspects, obviously, it's a multifaceted and shape-shifting insanity, but I advise that that insanity consists of two essential components. One is biophobia, or a fear of life itself, a fear of all that thrives and works together in the beauty and symbiosis of this planet, a fear and a repulsion to life itself, combined with strategies of pretending and make-believe. Remember that this capacity to pretend and make-believe is not in itself something bad. In fact, it's one of the gifts of our endowment from the Pleromic Aeons. Paranoia is the pretending or make-believe faculty. But when it combines with biophobia, it leads to that phenomena that we call evil, which is purely of human origin. So that's the lesson we learned in the first instance. The lesson to be learned now, as we approach the moment on December 3rd when Jupiter and the Earth conjunct in the constellation of the Bull, that is to say, when the Earth overtakes Jupiter on its orbital track, the lesson that to be learned at this moment is about violence. Now, I want you to consider closely the difference between evil and violence, and also consider their relationship to each other. And one way to do that is by asking this question. Well, do people committing evil use violence? The answer is obvious. They certainly do. Either they commit violence themselves directly, that is harming others, or they commit violence by proxy, as for instance, someone like a vicious psychopath like Hillary Clinton would do. I don't know if Hillary Clinton has ever killed anyone with her own hands, strangled anyone with her own hands. I rather doubt it, but it is possible. Probably would have been a child if she did so. But we do know that Hillary Clinton has committed a lot of evil by proxy, as have many other famous paranoid psychotics in recent history. Trotsky, Lenin, Stalin. Take your pick. So, those human animals who commit evil use violence to do so. But now ask this question. Is every use of violence an act of evil? Well, some people might say so, because some human animals have convinced themselves that any expression or act of violence whatsoever is morally objectionable. And they take what is called the higher moral ground, which often leads to the stance of pacifism and often leads to the claim that violence cannot be used to respond to violence, and that violence only breeds more violence, or that by acting with violence, we place ourselves on the very level of the violent people that we wish to overcome, and so forth, and so forth, and so on. Well, all of those considerations and rationalizations are very rapidly being blown to smithereens. And what comes as an opportunity now with the lesson of Jupiter in the bull, the second great lesson of the 3 years of correction, what comes now is the opportunity to see the origin of the human capacity for violence. Now, I put it to you, my friends, that the word violence and the syntax regarding violent behavior is not contained in the message we're using for Channel 16. That's fine, but it is contained in the lesson of the bull, comprehensively speaking. So, although it does not apply at this point, it is not the language of violence, the word violence is not incorporated into our use of this telepathic channel. It is in the background all the time. And you may well think of the head of the bull in the Picasso image as a representation of violence that has been, what's the word? Well, literally, cut off from its source, cut off from its dynamic or motor force. The motor force of the violent thrust of the bull is, of course, the bull's massive body, its legs, its torso, its shoulders. The head of the bull, severed from the body, is literally an image of decapitation. So, let's say that the decapitated bull represents the incapacitation of violence. It doesn't mean that violence is removed. It doesn't mean that violence is made to disappear. It doesn't mean that we deny its existence anymore. It dissolves into the ethers. No, it still exists, potentially, but it has been incapacitated. And so the man in this image is offering the proof that he, the male of the species, has incapacitated violence. And in this ritual, dance, somehow, man and woman celebrate that fact, and the woman plays her role in sealing the fate of violence. Men and women together must seal the fate of human violence in its destructive expression. And I said years ago that the feminist movement was a failure, and there's many reasons for that, and I could talk about feminism for a long time, but I won't go on a digression about that right now. The movement was sabotaged and rigged from the beginning, unfortunately, and it's absolutely alarming to see how many of the women in the feminist movement were posajis, that is to say, persons of self-assigned Jewish identity. It's extremely alarming. If the women's movement was supposed to represent women, that is to say, the gender of the human female animal across the planet, then the least that you could expect was that some of the feminist ideologues of the 60s and 70s would have been of various races and nationalities, you know, a Norwegian Scandinavian woman, maybe a Native American woman, maybe a German Aryan type woman, maybe some women from India, but no, no, no. All of the feminist ideologues were Jewish. Why? What does that say about the nature of the movement? The feminist movement was corrupted from the beginning, from the get-go. But the game is not over yet. And I made the observation some years ago that in feminism, women began a fight that they cannot finish by themselves. What I wish to suggest here, well, use that word I don't like, what I wish to indicate here is that the true, genuine, and humane motive behind feminism, if you could imagine such a thing, was really the concern for violence between men and women, not merely for about violence perpetrated by men on women, as was the emphasis with so many feminists, including Andrea Dworkin and Susan Brown Miller and so forth and so on. No, it cannot be a one-sided proposition. And insofar as there was anything genuine in feminism, the genuine part of it represents a battle that women undertook, which they cannot win on their own. Nor can men alone, nor can the males of the human species alone overcome their own enslavement to violence, or perhaps to put it more accurately, the enslavement and addiction to violence that is exhibited by men on this planet. Men cannot overcome that alone, nor can women overcome their particular form of perpetrating violence alone. And so what brings men and women together, and this I believe might be graphically indicated in the Picasso image, the test image for our Channel 16 experiment, is the common desire to see to the origins of violence and to see the test of violence. What is the test of violence? The human species is tested by its own capacity for violence. But what is that test? And how can that test be mastered? You know, I for one think it would be a wonderful thing if men and women could face each other and admit their complicity in violence insofar as there is such complicity. But that would only be the beginning. It's unfortunate that men and women commit violence of various kinds on each other. But that would only be the beginning, that admission, a humbling but necessary admission. Beyond that, I would love to see men and women make a pact and form another kind of complicity, that is, to become complicit through love and respect for each other and through love and respect for gender differences. To become complicit in overcoming the destructive expressions of violence. So that thought sort of brings me around to the end of this briefing, and it also brings me back to the larger theme that I outlined in the previous briefing, focusing the GNE. Recall that I said that the sacred dreaming power of the Mother Goddess of this planet, which sustains all life on this planet, and that includes psychic as well as biological life, that sacred dreaming power is beyond good and evil. And that sacred dreaming power, which is divine imagination, is the subject of our telepathic tests. Because the objective of this telepathic test, at this point in the testing stage, is to see if we can generate a kind of state of altered awareness among ourselves, those of us in the GNE, those of us who tune in, using the call sign GNE516 to see if we can generate as a group a Nahual experience for ourselves, that we can shift ourselves into a heightened state of perception. And in that heightened state of perception, we can see and know and realize what are the masculine and feminine polarities of that divine imagination of the planetary animal mother. That's the goal right now. That's the initial goal of this experiment. And all you have to do is not think about it, not run it into a rut, not try to tackle it and master it intellectually, not wear your brain out as if it were a brain teaser. No, but simply to broadcast the message to the channel so that it is routed through that channel back to you, one, specifically to other people on the same channel, two, and generically and collectively broadcast into the subconscious of the human race. And then we sit back and watch the results. So I hope this talk, this briefing, no, I don't hope anything. It's another syntax glitch. I guess I'm a little bit daffy today. It's a beautifully crisp and cool autumn day on the eve of Samhain, or the Celtic festival of the dead. And I don't mean to say that I hope, I mean to say that I wish, and I hold the aspiration that my briefings are clear and that the lucidity of your own minds may be enhanced by listening to what I say. So that is the message for now. You're all briefed and prepped for the next test of Channel 16. A little less than 48 hours from now. And I will proceed with other briefings and with the completion of Crew Notes number 22 and get them out to you on the first possible occasion. Thanks as always for listening, and safe passage to all.